Your views on America today? What are your views on America's future? Can we talk? Call in 212-209-2877. Wednesday, 8 to 9 p.m. on WBAI 99.5 on your radio dial.
WBAI New York, it's 10 a.m. and coming up next is Ecologic.
Pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? It'd be paradise, put up a parking lot.
If they keep on polluting the earth, tell me where we gonna plant our seed. It makes me wanna cry for the children.
See a windmill go, feel the pull of an ocean wave, the heat from a volcano. There's so much we could do, there's so much we could know, if we listen to the earth.
Welcome. Glad you could join us for Ecologic. Clean air and water are healthy air and water. Every day is Earth Day. I'm Ken Gale.
I'm Sally Gellert.
And I'm Donna Stein. And this is Ecologic for Wednesday, October 18th, 2023.
When your air or water are clean, thank an environmentalist. If not, become one. Enough said.
Today we are featuring two great books as a package that we're calling the Ecologic Science Book Club.
Before we go any further, we'd like to congratulate Sally Gellert on winning the election for a staff seat on the local station board, along with Jim Freund and Simon Fitzgerald. Congratulations as well to the winning listener candidates, Elliot Crown, Paul DiRienzo, Gloria Guillo, Mark Crispin Miller, Joan DiLorenzo, Alejandro Murphy, Serene Roberts, Eleanor Elizabeth Foreman, and Gail Bay.
That's Alejandrina, or Allie, as we call her. Friends of Liberty State Park in Jersey City are calling all who are able to come out to the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection's open house tonight at 6 p.m. This will be held at the park's railroad terminal and is the first major phase of LSB's revitalization recommendations to show continuing grassroots support and have the opportunity to provide input. They are kicking off this new positive improvements chapter with grassroots strength and demonstrating the decades of broad public consensus for a central type park. The department will afterwards show the plans on its revitalization webpages.
There are two events coming up this weekend for those interested in the environmental benefits of passenger rail. First, on Saturday, October 21st at 12:30 p.m., the National Rail Users Network holds a virtual mini-conference on passenger rail and the environment, natural allies. And the next morning, on Sunday, October 22nd, 11 a.m., at the Ethical Culture Society of Bergen County in Teaneck, and on Zoom, there is a panel discussion on Transit, the Sustainable Alternative, at which I am one of the panelists. We have information for both events on ecoradio.org.
What does the human immune system have to do with birds' sense of smell? Nature is amazing.
In today's episode, we look back to our Celebration of Nature series episode when we talked with Danielle Whitaker, author of The Secret Perfume of Birds.
Let's go to our first segment with Dr. Danielle Whitaker. The twists and turns her research took are as interesting as the research itself. Here's Danielle.
Hi, and thank you. I'm happy to be here.
You pioneered this brand new field. Tell us more about it.
Yeah, so I study how birds use their sense of smell to communicate with each other. And before I started doing this research, only a handful of people had ever looked into that. And one of the reasons why is because there is this longstanding myth that birds don't have a sense of smell, which I thought was a really strange idea. I mean, smell is a pretty important sense. And when somebody first said that to me, I thought, why would that even be? So I started doing some research with songbirds to, first of all, test whether they were actually able to smell each other. And then it led to a whole area of research for me, learning to understand how they use their senses of smell and why.
So this field didn't even exist before you took on this research?
I wouldn't say it didn't exist. There were definitely people who came before me. There was some research in the 1950s and 1960s by true pioneers in the field, like Bernice Wenzel, who studied physiology and behavior surrounding birds and their sense of smell, and Betsy Bang, who studied the shape of birds' nostrils inside their beaks. She actually did these wonderful illustrations looking at cross sections of the structure inside birds' beaks. And then there were a few other behavioral biologists in the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s who were starting to look at this, but primarily in birds like turkey vultures and seabirds. I was one of the first ever biologists to look at songbirds, small birds like the dark-eyed junco, which is the species that I study.
And the most common bird that you'll see at bird feeders.
Yes, they're extremely common at bird feeders.
Yeah, anybody who has a bird feeder has probably seen the junco. It was fascinating to see because your research was almost basic. Yeah, you know, I kind of wonder, why didn't anybody think of this before? And I guess it's that longstanding prejudice. I mean, I've been a birder a long time, and I've heard that my entire life.
Yes, we can actually thank John James Audubon for this myth. Began back in the 1830s. It was accepted even then that turkey vultures use their sense of smell to find dead animals. You would see them circling from high up in the air, and it's a long way for an animal to see. And he didn't believe it. He believed that birds were so reliant on vision that there had to be some kind of evolutionary trade-off. And so he did a whole set of experiments that weren't very well planned out, which he believed proved that turkey vultures actually used their sight rather than their sense of smell to find carrion. He did things like stick a dead pig underneath some hedges and wait for them to find it. And you can even read in his notes, if you read between the lines, they were there. They were circling above, and there were dogs attacking the carcass. So, but he concludes that, well, they didn't come down and get the pig, so they obviously couldn't smell it.
Dogs had nothing to do with that, right?
Exactly.
It is amazing. And I mean, you have this book, The Secret Perfume of Birds, and there's a bird on the cover. And yet it seems that there's as much about people in that book as there is about birds, because, you know, we're all vertebrates. We all have an immune system. We all have a sense of smell. And of course, they say humans can't smell very well either, which turned out not to be quite true. So what in the world does a junco being able to smell whether there's another bird nearby have to do with our immune system and how we choose a mate?
Yeah, that's a great question. So right away from the beginning, I was intrigued by the parallel. I had also heard my whole life that humans didn't have a very good sense of smell compared to other animals. And I've noticed that we don't really think about our sense of smell that much. And so, in fact, the idea that humans don't have a very good sense of smell even goes back to the same time period as the myth about birds. So this is another pretty cool historical study. Paul Broca, who's a brain anatomist, he had discovered an area of the brain called called Broca's area, named for him, and that's a part of the brain that produces speech. But when he was studying brains, he was looking at the shape of the human brain and how our forebrain, where we have our conscious thought, is so much larger than the rest of the brain. And our olfactory bulb, that's the part of the brain that interprets information from your nose, it's where we process smell, is quite small compared to the rest of the brain. And the idea then was that smell was this like animalistic, primitive sense, that humans had evolved past that.
Right.
And Paul Broca believed that the forebrain was the seat of free will, and that we had given up our good sense of smell in order to have free will and be thinking creatures and not reacting to these primitive impulses. So the whole time I've been studying the sense of smell in birds, I've been thinking in the back of my mind about how humans use smell too, and how maybe we're actually reacting to smell, things that we smell in our environment, in ways that we're not really processing mentally in the front of our brain. So by setting out to look at, you know, whether birds were using smell and what kinds of information they were communicating to each other, I was also still thinking about how we were probably doing the same thing.
And what did you find?
Well, I found a lot of strong evidence that there's a ton of information present in a bird's their scent. So birds have this one gland located above the base of their tail. It's called the uropygial gland. It produces an oil called preen oil. We call it that because birds spread it over their feathers while they're preening. This oil gives off an odor, and by looking at the composition of that odor and comparing it to the biology of the bird, I found that it communicates information about who they are, how healthy they are, how aggressive they are, whether or not they are capable of producing a lot of surviving offspring. So it's really useful for another individual, another bird, to sense that, to get that smell. And there's information there for them to process to understand, would this be a good mate? Is this maybe a strong rival competitor that maybe I don't want to mess with because they're super healthy and aggressive? Or is it somebody that I could overpower pretty easily? Maybe they're not in good health. Is this a female that will take care of her offspring? Or maybe she won't be that interested, you know, so there's a lot of information there. And just through reading, I've learned there's a lot of similar information in human scent.
Would that relate to pheromones?
Yeah, so pheromones are kind of a loaded word in science. We'll use them a lot when talking with lay people because it's a word we're familiar with. The idea that, you know, we give off a scent that can attract you, especially in terms of mate choice or sexual attraction. But the way that biologists define pheromones, those are odors or substances that induce a very specific response in the receiver. So, for example, there's a very well understood pheromone in rabbits. It's a suckling pheromone. So rabbit mothers will give off this scent that when their offspring, when their baby rabbit smell it, it will induce them to find the mother's nipples and nurse on her. So it's a very specific behavioral response. What we tend to think of when we talk about pheromones, like especially if we're thinking about the idea of human pheromones, is that it's a sexy scent, right? It's an attractive scent that will draw people to you. But what we see more of, and we understand a little bit better, are these other kinds of scents. So these are chemical signals. You can also think of them as signature mixtures. So if you think about like perfumes, they have these different odors that go into them that create a whole, and you can sense different concentrations of like rose or lemon or lily, I don't know. And you can find those same scents in different mixtures. But the idea here is that we all produce, everybody in the same species produces the same basic set of scents, but we all have our own signature mixture of different amounts of those. And so it's not a pheromone in the sense that it induces a reaction in us, but it's a chemical signal in the sense that we're smelling it, we're getting information, and it's different from every person. So pheromones, on the other hand, they're all exactly the same for everyone. So all those rabbit mothers, they produce the exact same pheromone that their baby bunnies will smell.
And that's why our promotional meme has bunnies on it. You can see the meme on our website, ecoradio.org. It is interesting how the scientific meaning of pheromone is different from how we ordinary folks think of it, more as individual scents, which also have their role. Here's more from Danielle.
You say that the birds know what insects not to eat, like they know not to eat a monarch butterfly. Is that related to the sense of smell as well?
I'm sure it is, yes. There's some good studies looking at how birds might use scent to find food. So, for example, we know that seabirds flying over miles and miles of open ocean can actually detect the presence of fish through the scent given off by clusters of phytoplankton in the ocean. They give off a scent called dimethyl sulfide, and that's where you're going to find fish feeding. So we know that animals, including birds, use scent to find food. There's other examples as well. I'm not sure.
And so do people.
Restaurants
open their doors and you'll smell what they're serving.
Yeah, I used to run by a donut shop. I'd always be really attracted. That was like a pheromone right there. But we also know when food's not good, right? So if you had some old milk in the refrigerator and you open it, you sniff it first to make sure that it's still good, and you'll know right away when it's not. And yeah, other animals, including birds, are able to do the same thing.
This led you to study bacteria because they're responsible for these smells in people and birds and everybody.
Yes. This came about as a little bit of a surprise to me because I'd been really hyper-focused on animals and thinking about them as their own entities. And one day I was giving a presentation on my work and talking about what compounds I had identified in these odors. And Kevin Tice, who's a microbiologist, said, those are all known byproducts of microbial metabolism. Have you looked at whether there's bacteria in the gland actually producing these odors? And it just kind of blew me away. I hadn't even given that any thought. Yes, yeah. It's amazing how much you can learn from the people around you.
We had another Celebration of Nature show just on microbes. It's a huge subject.
Started looking at bacteria. So we first, looked at whether there were bacteria there. We did a genetic study and found that there were hundreds of species of bacteria that live in Junco glands. And I've learned that there's been a lot of work on this in mammals. So mammalian scent glands are full of bacteria, and those odors that they give off that they use for scent marking are not actually created by the animals themselves. It's given off by bacteria that are symbiotic, that live with them. And they benefit from each other. So the bacteria benefit by being able to consume, the secretions in those scent glands, and the animals benefit by having these odors that they use to communicate with each other. Bacteria are important in all kinds of biological systems. We're most familiar with them in terms of digestion. We know a lot more now about our gut microbiome than we used to. We know how important that is for our health, but we also have bacteria in other body systems. They're important in brain development. In our behavior, they influence how we smell, and we just keep learning more and more all the time about these wonderful friends.
You have a great quote about bacteria drive animal behavior, including us, such as kissing, grooming, and food sharing. And you have to raise an eyebrow, kissing? Bacteria make us kiss each other? What's going on here?
Give me some of that bacteria.
So that's from the idea that, these are symbiotic bacteria. We benefit them, they benefit us. And a huge benefit to the bacteria is us spreading them to other people so they can expand, where they live. And there's the idea that we have these kinds of behaviors, things like kissing, that have evolved because it was beneficial to our bacteria for us to pass on our bacteria. And when you think about kissing, it's a little bit of a strange activity, right? You don't see all other animals doing that. Like, why are we putting our mouths on each other? And so this might have been something that evolved over time because it helped both us and our bacteria.
Yeah, there's that song, you get enough germs to catch pneumonia. And now we know you get enough germs to prevent pneumonia.
Yeah, our healthy immune system is really dependent on a healthy microbiome. What we think of as the good bacteria, the ones that help us, they produce antibacterial substances that help fight off pathogenic bacteria. So they really do work in ways that help both us and them.
Some of you are going to want to give the secret perfume of birds to a bird lover, but when you get it, if you read just a bit, you'll want your own copy. When you show off these books to family and friends, you can tell them proudly that you got them from WBAI. This next section has never been on the radio before, only on the Environment TV. Here's Danielle talking about feminism and science.
In your last chapter, you talked about feminism.
Oh, wow.
And, you want to talk about that?
Sure. Yeah. I noticed a pattern where everybody is studying this question of whether or not birds do smell. Nearly all of us are women. And I thought that was kind of an interesting thing to point out, especially when we're looking at something that, we're dealing with this longstanding myth that, some very prominent men had said was the way things were. And it seems like it's mostly women who were investigating, well, wait a minute, maybe this is not how things are. And that's actually actually come up a lot in animal behavior studies. Things like this paradigm that, you know, males have all the say in mate choice, right? Like, well, they do all this work to attract females and they're flashy and they're there to, you know, fight each other and protect the offspring and all that. And female birds in particular, we think of them as like little brown drab things that their only goal is to lay eggs and help raise the offspring. And they're very passive otherwise. But there's this really cool research questioning that idea and finding that females often fight, you know, they fight for their territory just as much as males do. There are many female species that actually sing like males do. The thing is that most of those are in the tropics. So when we think about birds, we often think about North American birds like the juncos and the cardinals and the blue jays. And there's a whole world of birds in the tropics that we don't know as much about their biology. And their females are brightly colored. They sing. They fight. Right? They do all these male these male behaviors. And it's a lot of women scientists who started looking at that and started questioning the accepted paradigm. But actually, having brought up cardinals, they're an interesting example, too, because females have that crest, right? That big, bright crest. They're not as bright red as the males, but they have this ornament that we think of as a male ornament. And people had previously explained that away as, well, females have it just as a side effect of males having it. They don't really use it for anything. But it is also important. Female cardinals are very aggressive, it turns out. So, again, that was researched by a female scientist.
Well, I remember reading years ago that in the 70s, the number of women going to college was becoming equal to the number of men going to college. And then in the 80s, the number of women majoring in science was equal to the number of men majoring in science. And, you know, I think about my aunt who went to college to find a husband back in the 50s. And that doesn't seem to be the case anymore.
At this point, I think
that's more right.
Women in college than men, at least at the undergrad level.
Yeah.
That's right. There are more women in college at the undergrad level, and we see comparable levels of men and women in graduate school in the biological sciences. One of the problems that's still happening, though, is we tend to lose women in later career stages. And a lot of that is because women are facing discrimination or more difficulty advancing in their careers. They face different kinds of scrutiny when they are going up for tenure, for example. People write letters of recommendation using different language, whether they're talking about a man or a woman. And so there are still inequalities, even though, you know, we're trying to put more women out there into the pipeline.
These aren't the type of books you'll hear about on mainstream radio, and certainly not on mainstream TV. But we bring you the books and their authors right here on Ecologic on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org.
In the Secret Perfume of Birds, part science, part intellectual history, and part memoir, Whitaker uses humor, clear writing, and a compelling narrative to create a book that is as much a celebration of science as it is about birds specifically. This fascinating book can be yours with a donation of $45 or as a part of our Science Book Club package for a $75 donation, either of which includes your WBAI membership. Just call 212-209-2950.
Too often people think about science as dry, but a book with chapters including Following the Bird's Nose, What Does Sexy Smell Like? MHC, Magical Happiness Controller, and Girl Power, it's clearly written for everyone. We'll send you a copy for your membership donation of just $45. So call 212-209-2950 and ask for The Secret Perfume of Birds. Or join our Ecologic Book Club with a donation of $75 or more and get Exploring Tritium Dangers, too. You'll find them both on ecologic.wbai.org.
I just loved reading this book, and I'm sure you'll love it, too. Non-scientists will appreciate that Dr. Whitaker clearly explains all the jargon words. People who are thinking of a career in science will certainly appreciate her procedures. And everyone can relate to how life takes on unexpected paths and opens new horizons. To join us and get your book, go to www.givetowbai.org or call 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. And of course, we would like you to become a BAI buddy to hear more of this kind of programming that you won't hear anywhere else.
If you're especially interested in birds, in addition to the secret perfume of birds, you might be interested in Dennis Edge's beautiful and interesting photo book, The Birds of Tompkins Square Park, for a $60 donation. Our friend Corrine Willinger got it yesterday for her 96th birthday, and she loved it. She started looking through it right away during her own birthday party. Call 212-209-2950.
We'll be back to talk with Arjun Makhdani, exploring tritium dangers in a few minutes, in particular the dangers to pregnant moms and fetuses. WBAI is listener-supported, and listeners often forget to donate unless asked, so please, we beseech you to help fund this marvelous experiment in free speech.
If you know a student who doesn't know what to do in college, let them know that even someone as accomplished as Dr. Whitaker has changed career paths several times before she became the acclaimed pioneer of a new field of science. She went from being an English major to a primate researcher, to overturning accepted thoughts on an entire family of animals, to researching how our own smell system works, again in ways that went against previously accepted dogma.
And there's a soap opera aspect to The Secret Perfume of Birds. You'll get to go with Danielle on her personal journey through lab work and field research.
Ah, the smell of cookies. Huh?
We hope you're enjoying this program as much as we are enjoying revisiting these interviews. And we think you'll like it even more when you have the time to sit with your own copies. The Secret Perfume of Birds, with its story of researching birds' sense of smell, and exploring tritium dangers to learn what to watch for as industry proposes dumping radioactive water into the Hudson River and others, are the books that we offer you today. You can have either book as our gift to you with your donation of $45, or join our Science Book Club to get both books with your donation of $75. Call 212-209-2950.
The first song in our original opening theme medley was This Earth by Judy Gorman. It's on the Swords into Plowshares 2-record vinyl album. The album was divided into sections, but the environmental section only had one song, Judy's. I played This Earth on the first or second episode of Ecologic back in 2002 and got a call from Judy Gorman asking, where did I get that song? It was not yet on any of her albums or CDs. Since then, she has made an excellent video using that song. It's on YouTube and it's linked on our website. Thank you, Judy, for this excellent song. Here's Judy Gorman's This Earth.
Bus to Boston, watch the winter trees like feathers against the sky. Brown hills long for spring that's coming soon, and the singing blackbirds fly, and the singing blackbirds fly. Oh, people, people, don't you love this earth we share with everything that grows? Don't you want to taste freedom? In this life, I believe we can make it whole again. I believe we can make it whole. I turn from the window to read the papers of madness, new lies, old greed, and another weapon more frightening than death, when we could cherish the earth and sing. Cherish the earth and sing. Oh, cherish the earth. Share with everything that grows. Don't you want to taste freedom and peace in this life? I believe we can make it whole again. I believe we can make it whole. We pass threadbare cities of fiery hopes for this earth, this spinning jewel. I swear that before before our time is done, I want to see this old world renewed. See this world renewed. See this world renewed. See this world renewed. Oh, people, people, don't you love this earth? We share with everything that grows. Don't you want to taste freedom and peace in this life? I believe we can make it whole again. Boston, watch the winter trees like feathers against the sky. Brown hills long for spring that's coming soon, and the singing blackbirds fly, and the singing blackbirds fly. Oh, people, people, don't you love this earth? You share with everything that grows. Don't you want to taste freedom and peace in this life? Make it whole again. I believe we can make it whole.
That was This Earth by Judy Gorman. It's such an important song, and we're glad to be able to play all of it. We really need Judy's optimism.
You're listening to Ecologic, WBAI's premier environmental show, right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org. I'm Donna Stein.
I'm Sally Gellert.
And I'm Ken Gale. Let's talk about our second book, Exploring Tritium Dangers. But Donna, you mentioned the smell of cookies while talking about Danielle's book.
Yeah, let's tell people about that.
And she had a cowbird in a bag, in a paper bag, and she said, it smells like cookies. So she's walking around the lab and putting the bag under every scientist's nose and going, smell this. Doesn't it smell like cookies? And the image of her doing that, I just think is wonderful. What was that lab like with her in it? our second book, Exploring Tritium Dangers. Dr. Arjun Makhijani has an incredible book on tritium, and reading it brought me back to my early days in the safe energy movement, reading John Gottman's books. Dr. Makhijani was as pleased as my comparison of him with John Gottman as I was to have noticed the similarity of that great man.
It's great that these expert scientists can make their subjects so accessible and interesting so that we can learn easily. Sometimes we are intimidated in a classroom setting, but reading a book like Danielle's or Arjun's gives you a chance to pace yourself, to get involved in stories and anecdotes that really draw you in.
Exploring Tritium Dangers is comprehensive, yet easy to read, and you'll have a new recognition of the risks we run. We hope that you'll want to get your own copy with a donation of $45, or join our Ecologic Science Book Club with a donation of $75. Call 212-209-2950.
Here's Arjun talking about tritium and health, including what we might expect as massive amounts of tritiated water from Fukushima Daiichi are dumped in the Pacific Ocean. The voices you hear are Dr. Arjun Makhijani and Dr. Gordon Edwards, another tritium expert.
One of the reasons I wrote this book, Exploring Tritium Dangers, is the way tritium's being generally considered in terms of radioactive hazards is exactly because it combines with oxygen and makes radioactive water. And since we pass water through our systems relatively rapidly, so for instance, in the nuclear weapons establishment, if somebody got a tritium exposure, they'd give them a six-pack of beer or tell them to drink more coffee. But there's some scientific basis for that. You pass it through your body faster, so you get a lesser radiation dose. What hasn't happened is looking at other aspects of damage than cancer to grown-ups. And that's why I wrote this book. So because tritium gets into every cell, cytoplasm, which is most of the cell, is mostly water. It ionizes the water. It breaks it up into very reactive pieces. One of those pieces is a hydroxyl radical. It's extremely reactive, and it damages the mitochondrial DNA. Mitochondria are little remnants of bacteria. We have hundreds to thousands of them in every cell, and they are what makes your heart beat. They are what makes your arms move. They are what makes your eyes go. So they are the energy engine of the body. They convert the food into molecules that can be that can give you mechanical energy. The mitochondrial DNA doesn't have as much repair mechanism as the nuclear DNA, the one we talk about, the double helix. This is not the double helix. This has its own circular DNA, hundreds of them in every cell. And they don't have the repair mechanism, but they're the energy system of the body.
Ooh.
That's one thing. And the other thing is, early in pregnancy, if the embryo is damaged, you can have early failed pregnancies, you can have malformations. For certain malformations involving the central nervous system, there's no dose below which the risk of that damage is zero. All of that has been ignored. We asked the National Academies in 1999 to pay attention. They said, yeah, okay, we will. And then they published the report and they said, maybe some other time. I mean, those are not the exact words, but, and that was in 2006, and I'm still waiting. And so part of the push to the establishment to pay attention to pregnant women, to pay attention to fetal health. We talk so much about that. When does life begin? All that. I'm saying, okay, then why aren't we paying attention to the dangers of tritium and other radionuclides that cross the placenta?
It could be because there is a company narrative that everybody hears in the mass media that, tritium, it's a 12-year half-life, big deal. And I've spoken to very intelligent people who actually buy into that and think it's no big deal. It's that not realizing that half-life means half and half and half and half. By the time you're done, it's 144 years or whatever. But, so it's a company narrative that we have to really be careful of, and why people are not knowing and not caring and putting it off.
Well, okay, we know how dangerous tritium is and how dangerous, you know, ionizing radiation is. Where does it come from?
Oh, yeah. Well, there's both man-made tritium and nature-made tritium. There is a certain amount of tritium that is created and has been for millions of years in the upper atmosphere by cosmic radiation. And this comes to Earth and causes a certain amount of tritium in the environment. However, when we talk about the tritium from the Pilgrim plant, or when we talk about tritium from the Indian Point plant, we're talking about human-made tritium. The nuclear reactors mass-produce tritium in large amounts. And the way they do that is by activating non-radioactive materials. Again, I want to distinguish between radioactive materials, which are exploding atoms, and non-radioactive materials, which are not exploding, never explode. So they're fundamentally different, and yet they behave identically. If you have radioactive hydrogen and non-radioactive hydrogen, they behave the same way chemically. They enter the same combinations. They go into your body the same way, go to the same organs, go to the fetus, for example, except that these atoms are exploding and causing random damage, and that triggers cancers and other kinds of diseases. This stuff is man-made and human-made, and it gets out into the environment in large amounts. We heard recently about Japan dumping a huge amount of tritium into the Pacific Ocean. Well, that goes on around the world from nuclear plants of all kinds all the time, actually.
And Arjun, you talk about the above-ground nuclear tests, and that made tritium that's still with us?
Well, some of it is still with us. Most above-ground nuclear tests stopped in 1963 with the U.S., Soviet, British Partial Test Ban Treaty. But France continued into the 70s and China until 1980, which is when the last atmospheric test was. So most of the tritium is gone. Then what happens? Because it becomes water, it evaporates with the regular water, comes down as rain. So by now, the tritium from testing is very dilute. So let me give you some numbers. In rivers, your tritium will be, should I talk in American units? Yeah, 25, 30 picocuries per liter, about one becquerel per liter. And in the oceans, it's 1/10 of a becquerel per liter, so 1/10 of that. What Japan will be dumping into the Pacific Ocean as their upper limit of tritiated water is 1,500, so 15,000 times the ocean concentration. So it will make a difference to the creatures that are living in the bottom of the sea. It's the same tritium that's human-made and natural-made. It's the concentrations that are different. And a thing I'd like to say is if Mother Nature does something to you, it doesn't give your neighbor. So Mother Nature will, you know, gives us birth and we will all die. And dying is often a pretty painful process. But if your neighbor comes up to you and says, Mother Nature is going to harm you, you know, you'll hurt a lot when you die. Let me punch you in the nose. You would say, no, no, it's a much smaller dose. No, no. You don't let your neighbor punch you in the nose unless you invite him to teach you boxing or something. But so the whole idea that, you know, there's so much natural tritium, so we can dump two is philosophically and morally completely wrong. That's why in the IAEA, International Atomic Energy Agency regulations, it says if you're going to introduce some harms, you should calculate the benefits, and the benefits should exceed the harms. Well, most people in the Pacific region will get no benefits. Right. So the thing is not justified. We've been pointing this out again and again and again. And the International Atomic Energy Agency said, well, we're not going to consider that part of our regulation in evaluating this because the harms will be negligible. What Japan is dumping, and they have started dumping, is not just tritium, tritiated water. There are traces of other radionuclides, which per unit of radioactivity are a lot more harmful, strontium-90, cesium-137. In the tanks where there's more than a million tons of water, there's even some plutonium, there are sludges, there's cobalt-60. And what they haven't done is done the science properly to see what this will do to the ecosystems. And I'm part of an expert panel advising the Pacific region countries on this matter. And a couple of our people are ocean scientists. And they've said, look, cobalt-60 will concentrate in the bottom sediments more than 300,000 times. And you haven't considered that. Well, you know, so they haven't done the science before they've said it's going to be all right.
Some of the many topics covered by exploring tritium dangers are physical and radiological features of tritium, discharges to and concentrations of tritium in the environment, pathways and residence times of tritium in the human body, and harm from internal radiation. You'll want to know about what we can expect if large amounts of tritium are dumped into the Hudson River or any waterway near a nuclear reactor. So you can donate $45 for Exploring Tritium Dangers or get our Science Book Club package when you donate $75. Remember, any donation of $25 or more includes your annual voting membership to WBAI.
This next piece seems to be what made the biggest impression even among seasoned activists. Arjun provides details on what is known, but we choose not to study.
We've alluded briefly about the effect of radioactivity on pregnancy. And let's talk about that in greater detail. We'll start with you, Arjun.
Yeah, so let me relate some of the evidence where that comes from. So on first principles, knowing what ionizing radioactivity is, the one that splits apart molecules, we can infer a lot of things, but there's also epidemiological evidence. Now, epidemiological evidence appears only when there's a certain number of problem outcomes, like cancers or other diseases. At a lower levels, you don't really see it. So it's significant whenever you see epidemiological evidence, you know, surveying populations for health problems. So the survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki have been one of the primary populations for understanding the impacts of radiation. And there were women who were pregnant at the time of the bombings. Now, some of those pregnancies actually went to term and those children were born. Not all, of course. And those children were medically followed up for problems. One of the problems that was found was what is called in the official medical reports severe mental retardation. That may not be politically the most appropriate word today, but that's what is in the documents. And it's described as people who can't speak properly and who cannot take care of their bodily function, so who need continuing medical care for their lives. And it was found that this kind of damage during pregnancy occurs with no threshold. That is, a small amount of radioactivity exposure during pregnancy will create a small risk of these severe neurological outcomes. And this has been known since the 1980s in official publications, International Commission on Radiological Protection, which are sort of the standard global official references for radiation impacts. Yet we have no protections for pregnant women at all in the general population. The only pregnancies that are protected in terms of limiting dose are in the nuclear workplaces, like in nuclear reactors, and there fetuses are limited to 500 millirem, which is 5 millisieverts, which is 5 times the annual dose allowed to the general population. That's the standard in the United States. I think it's stricter in Canada. But even so, fetal doses equal to the general population is an outrageously loose standard. And the vast majority of women are not even protected by that. And we've been asking for protections of this kind and for children, especially for, as I've said before, in the first part of the show, for 25 years of the National Academies, and they haven't yet agreed even to study it. So there's actual evidence. So how much radiation crosses the placenta, that's also been studied. It's in ICRP publications. So in the case of tritium, for example, the fetus will have a greater concentration of tritium because of how the flows across the placenta work than the mother. If the mother is exposed to plutonium or cesium or strontium before pregnancy, that will remain in her body and that will cross the placenta. So even exposure before pregnancy of radionuclides inside the body affects the fetus. So it's not just exposure during the pregnancy. And despite all of that, essentially, it's very weird. Let me say one last thing, is in the 50s and early 60s, the impacts on children were being considered. You know, like these children were being followed up at Hiroshima and Nagasaki and so on. But when, at the end of the 50s, the general public started becoming the focus of special radiation protection regulations apart from workers, somehow consideration of children in radiation studies seems to have disappeared for about 20 years. Wow. Until the 1990s. Now, we know children are much more impacted per unit of dose, girl children more than boy children, but all children more than adults.
Wow.
We hope you will donate for any of the premiums that you find on ecologic.wbai.org. We've needed a book like Exploring Tritium Dangers for a long time. It's the only book of its kind. And with the risk of tritium being dumped in the Hudson River, we all need to learn all we can about the possible health effects of this radioactive substance. Isn't it worth $45 to know about something this important? Call 212-209-2950 to get your copy of Exploring Tritium Dangers and become a member of WBAI at the same time. That membership alone is a $25 value.
Corporations have co-opted science and research, and it becomes difficult for authors to find publishers for their work, as even universities that are supposed to be doing independent research are funded by industry. Arjun found that this is to be the case with his study of the effects of radioactivity on human health. He had to go to a private sponsor, K-Drive, for this book.
There's more information in Dr. Makajani's book than we can possibly fit into this show. Like Danielle Whitaker, Dr. Makajani writes in plain English. Even though he includes a lot of hard science in the book, it's easy to understand. Have you been enjoying Arjun Makajani's comments today? Wouldn't you like to take this info home with you? The next best thing to having Dr. Makajani there with you is having his book, Exploring Tritium Dangers. A donation of just $45 brings you the book and a year's membership to WBAI. Quite a good value. Yours by calling 212-209-2950.
If you want, you can send a check or money order for your membership and or premiums. Mail to WBAI Radio, Attention Membership, 388 Atlantic Avenue, Brooklyn, New York, 11217. That's 388 Atlantic Avenue, Brooklyn, 11217.
Well, it's time to wrap up. So thank you all for joining us. For more information, go to ecoradio.org. That's ecoradio.org. We also have an archive of our past shows. And don't forget to go to give2wbai.org or ecologic.wbai.org to join the Science Book Club or choose another premium for your donation.
And join us next Wednesday, October 25th at 10 a.m. To support Ecologic, you can donate any amount, get one of our premiums, or become a BAI buddy.
There's a limited number of these books, of both Secret Perfume of Birds and Exploring Tritium Dangers. So you want to donate, you want to pledge right away. And we'd love to stay in touch with you. So those of you online, please go to www.ecoradio.org and sign up for our email list. Those of you on Facebook, please like our page. We're WBAI Ecologic, no dashes.
WBAI is community radio, and there are lots of ways to get involved. And of course, we always need your donations. We need your contributions to support everything that makes a broadcast happen. The engineers, electricity, equipment upkeep, rent. Pledging as a BAI buddy now during this show really helps Ecologic especially.
It was really a pleasure researching these shows and getting a chance to read these books and explore areas that were totally new to me and really fascinating. I really think you'll enjoy joining our science book club. And maybe one of these days we can figure out a time to have a Zoom discussion of them. We'll keep listening. But in any case, we're always glad to have you with us for Ecologic, live or on the archives. And if you listen live, we may be able to take your call and answer your questions. This show will be on the archives and for WBAI in just 5 or 10 minutes.
I like the idea of getting together with a number of our listeners on Zoom to discuss either the Secret Perfume of Birds or Exploring Tritium Dangers. I would love to hear what you have to say about this. The books are wonderful, but I know our listeners are almost as wonderful, and I would love to hear what their thoughts are upon this. So we'll have to figure, we'll allow enough time for you to get the books and then enough time for you to read them, and we'll have to do something. We'll keep listening to Ecologic, and you can join our Zoom book club. And our thanks to our engineer, Michael G. Haskins. We couldn't do this without you. I'm Ken Gale.
I'm Sally Gellert.
And I'm Donna Stein. Join us next Wednesday, October 25th at 10 a.m. Or check our website for details. And we want to make a special shout out to thank and say happy birthday to Sally Gellert, our wonderful co-host.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining and being our listeners.
See the sun, how bright it shines on the nations of the earth. All who share this thing called life celebrate each day's rebirth.
So solar power, inexpensive energy. So
give me the power of the wind. Give me the power. many of you, like many Americans, I have felt frustrated and betrayed by the state of the mainstream media in this country. A media whose priorities seem out of step with their responsibilities. We need a media that strengthens democracy, not a media that strengthens the government. We need a media that enriches public discourse, not one that enriches corporations.
Hi, I'm Jane Fonda, and this is WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
A BAI buddy is a listener who doesn't just give to this station, but spreads their donation out throughout the year to help us plan for the future and take our current programming to the next level. Listeners like you are still critical for our survival. Now more than ever, the structured support BAI buddies offer is priceless. So go to givetowbai.org today. That's give, then the number 2, wbai.org, and become a BAI buddy. And a big thanks from all of us.
David Kenny of Everything Old is New Again every Sunday night at 10. Please join me then, and please support WBAI at our brand new old number, which is 212-209-2950. Again, that's 212-209-2950. Hey, it's our old number, but it's new again, because everything old is new again. I like it.
Okay, now you got a pitch.
Ask for money for WBAI?
Damn straight. You got to ask for money for WBAI, and you got to get people to give it, because you are now in charge of publicity and promotion, and if you don't get people to donate, we got to fire you.
So, I have to tell everyone that WBAI listener-supported free speech radio, truth and justice radio, radio for the 99.5% on 99.5 FM, is the best radio station in New York City, the only truly listener-supported station in New York City, and they should contribute to WBAI, become WBAI buddy members. And if they don't?
Then we gotta fire you.
You can't fire me.
Why?
Because I'm just a volunteer. WBAI doesn't have enough money to hire somebody to do publicity and promotion.
So what do we do instead?
How about a silly conversation like this that we can broadcast on the air and say, please support Peace and Justice, Free Speech Radio, radio for the 99.5% at 99.5 FM. Contribute. Become a WBAI buddy member.
On November 5th, 2023, from 5 to 8 p.m., Crossways Theater presents a fall festival of plays by award-winning writers on multicultural, multiracial New York at 165 West 86th Street and Amsterdam Avenue, the West Park Presbyterian Church. Plays are The Unexpected by Lionel Hamanaka, Collateral Damage from the Roe Reversal, Courtside by Nathaniel Blake Johnson, a couple at the end of their ropes in a bar, Cover Up by Howard Flanzer about the origins of COVID, and Winning Women, Basketball Champions, about Pat Summers, a famous basketball coach, by Kathleen Potts. That's November 5th from 5 to 8.
Then you
us way too cold. But we won't lose our mind, we won't be unkind. Cause they're home for a while, honor the zoo, them up a road, road, road. Now watch them and them guns and them blood money. Now watch them and them bombs creating them own agony.